distributing the future broadcast October 3rd, 2006, a Brussels walkabout.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We begin by walking around Brussels with 10 photographers on the eve of EuroOSCON. It feels like yet another metaphor for open source development. Piers Cawley explains why he still likes to shoot in black and white and why he will often still use film instead of digital. Finally, Douglas Arianas explains how you can help support community radio. Before we get started, I have a new toy to share with you. Michael Gohagen and Doug Kay at Gigavox released a new application this past weekend developed by Bruce Sharp. It's called the Levelator, and it's one of the best pieces of freeware you can add to your podcasting arsenal. It smooths out the audio levels in a WAV or an AIFF file so that the volume remains consistent throughout the file. For better or worse, there are no controls. You can't tweak it in any way. You just drop a file on it and watch it do its stuff. You can download it from gigavox.com/levelator, and we have links in the show notes. I used it on this first piece and immediately noticed the difference. It's like the old Madge commercial. You're soaking in it. I then reapplied the tool to the entire show. Okay, so this first piece is somewhat of the third leg in our metaphor series. We've heard that open source is like rock and roll and that it's like a tomato. Here I show you that it's also a bit like a semi-formal gathering of people set to take photographs of a beautiful city. James Duncan Davidson loves taking pictures with other people. He'll just pick up the phone and
say, hey, you want to get together and take pictures if you're in town or something? And, you know, maybe it happened, maybe it wouldn't. People like getting out and taking pictures and sometimes need a good excuse for it.
So it's almost 5:30 on a Sunday night outside the Hotel La Plaza in Brussels, Belgium, and Duncan doesn't know how many people to expect. One of them, Svet, says that he read blog reports of the last time Duncan organized a photography walkabout in Portland, Oregon, the night before OSCON, O'Reilly's open source convention. Svet said he emailed Duncan because
I was jealous about this photo walkout in Oregon, but it was not possible for me to go there, so I sent him. I ping him to do it again.
Ping him. That's geek talk for contact him. This ping did the trick. Duncan says that
Svet reminded me to do it, so I posted it to my blog, and all of a sudden, four or five people said, yeah, I'm in, almost immediately.
But this isn't Portland. This isn't a city that Duncan knows particularly well. He's just arrived from London the day before and hasn't had time to scout for great locations. But that's all taken care of. There was a little more chatter about his trip to Brussels on his blog.
And then one guy said, hey, I've got a friend who lives there and, you know, maybe he'll show us around. And then he wrote back a couple of days later and said, yep, he's in.
He is Eve. He's here because his friend asked him if he would and because he's hoping to show us
The nicest parts of Brussels. Things where tourists normally don't come.
Well, it's 5:45, not a lot of daylight left. The group follows Eve across the street and towards a park. They all stop at an overpass and take pictures. I'm baffled. If the others hadn't stopped and pointed their cameras, I never would have thought to take this shot. I look at the scene, but I don't really see what's there, and I don't really see what's not there. I ask Bert what it is that's there.
I think the parallax is actually pretty cool. But they're kind of cheating because of this thing on the side here. It's kind of built-in parallax. That's no fun.
Much later, after the photographers had posted these pictures to Flickr, I saw what it was that wasn't there that they were all seeing. Cars. Brussels streets had been closed to most automobile traffic for much of the day, and police were just beginning to open up the streets. These photographers saw a rare opportunity to shoot a usually busy street while there was no traffic on it. As we cross that street, I asked Bert what he hoped to get out of this adventure.
We'll learn something about photography, get some hints and tips.
Sure enough, as we crossed into the park, Duncan and Kathy were standing in front of a fountain experimenting with camera settings.
It makes it so silky-looking.
You see the half-second is even more silky. We back out to a tenth of a second, you can see a little bit streaky, where you can imagine some individual sheets of water coming in.
Right.
It's just 10 people taking pictures around Brussels, and yet It's a microcosm of what's meant by open source. Someone announced a project on the web, waited to see who would show up. Many different people at different levels of ability are here, and they each have their own reasons for joining. Yuri explains that he
saw Duncan's post about the walkabout. I was quite interested in meeting him, meeting the other people around him. I know Duncan's technology, Duncan's works, and
before Duncan became known as a photographer, his previous work included two well-known open-source Java applications. Engaging with the community is something that he does naturally. He's equally comfortable leading and looking on while others lead. He stands by as Stephen explains that you have to dance with your subjects.
The point in making pictures is moving through your knees.
Say that again?
You have to get down. People are lazy.
Right. Okay.
So they stand upright and they take
a picture.
That's
the only angle they have, yeah.
And that's a very, it's not very exciting angle because that's the way everybody looks. And you have to move with your subject because if you don't like dance with your subject, you never understand, you never create the tension which makes a good picture.
This differs from an open source project in that there's no explicit deliverable. The experience is the point. I look around. No one seems to be leading, and yet we're all moving ahead. I catch up with Duncan and ask him how this night in Brussels differs from the night in Portland a month and a half ago. It's very different, he says.
I don't know where the good stuff is, so, but that's okay because we have somebody here who does. So, it's a nice hotel.
Did you feel that? In the middle of talking to me about how the day is going, he's pulled towards an image that he needs to capture. You can hear his attention shift as that old hotel calls to him from across the street. I wander off and talk to Yuri, who's just completed a shot of the palace. I ask what he took.
Actually, just now I tried to take the sender with the flag on top. Not too much sky. A shot just representing Brussels. You could try to go for the tourist shot and try to get everything in one shot in a wide angle, but I tried to take details.
Kathy echoes this as her big takeaway. She's learned to think about
scale, both looking at very small elements and really macro elements instead of the kind of what you see in front of you snapshot mode that we sort of all grow up with.
The sun has set and we're nearing the end of our evening together. Some of the photographers compare their favorite shots. They all walked the same path and all came away with different things. Duncan shrugs and explains that the images they all captured say a lot about the person taking the picture.
You can take five great photographers and give them the same subject, put them in the same place, and you're going to get five totally different photographs out of it because everybody's got their own eye. You learn to know that you're not going to get everything. But what you need to work on is getting your shots.
I love that at the end of the piece, Duncan points out that it's the photographer and not the equipment, and yet at the same time, during the taping, the photographers were often looking at what each other was using, and Kathy planned to head out and buy a new lens the next day. Later in the week, I sat down with Pierce Cawley to talk about his passion for photography. He makes the point that color prints look beautiful initially, but soon fade. If you're taking color images, then he says you've got to move to digital. But these factors just don't hold for black and white photography. The prints can last a century, and the digital images just don't have the same range or feel as the prints. He begins our interview by proudly declaring,
I came to Euro-Oscon with a film camera. I'm actually quite passionate about continuing to shoot film. Digital cameras are eating colour film's lunch. If you want the old-fashioned print from negative C-type print nowadays, you are just barking up the wrong tree. The modern digital output is it lasts longer. You know, there's a whole generation of kids now who has to look at their parents' wedding photos and find this kind of grey, washed-out thing because their parents had it done in the new colour. Meanwhile, my parents, it was all shot in black and white, and they're still beautiful photographs. And there's this kind of generation for whom it was shot in colour, and it looked really nice for about 2 years. But it never got digitally captured. The negatives have rotted or been lost. And there's going to be a 10-15 year gap with no images. But coming back to the way black and white survives is that the process itself is just archivally more sound. The theory is, no one's quite sure, but as I understand it, the theory is that if you wash a black and white print correctly, you don't even need to tone it. It will last of the order of 100 years. If you then use gold toning or selenium toning, which makes the picture look nicer anyway, it increases contrast and changes colour and just looks gorgeous, then you are looking at very long lifetimes. If you go, I mean, the longest lifetime of a photographic process that we know is carbon, probably. And that the theory is that that will last longer than the paper on which it's printed. Carbon prints are beautiful. I've seen a couple of them, and it's just like, but the process for that, you find you kind of have to be a maker to do that. The process ingredients aren't that expensive, but the time and skill needed is enormous, and there are very few people still doing it. So if you went to someone like the Custom Lab in London, which still do these kind of weird old processes, you'd be looking at £100 for quite a small print. It's not a cheap process. It doesn't have to be a very expensive process, but it's a very rare process, so it is a very expensive process. Digital for black and white. For a long time, black and white output wasn't as good as colour output because you had colour shift issues. You would have inks that changed colour in different lights. You would have the colour in a black and white print. It's not straight black and white. There is often very subtle gradation of tone, and black and white photographers are used to being able to manipulate that. And when you find yourself printing something, this is beautiful, cool, gold tone look, and it comes out looking slightly warm and sepia, which just doesn't work for the image as far as you're concerned, then you're not a happy bunny. There's something nice about being in a dark room, getting your hands wet and that kind of process. And darkroom works so much easier in black and white. No one, I don't think there's anyone who would ever claim that they really loved working in the darkroom on colour. Why you don't capture in black and white and digital in this kind of environment, this is very dark, there's no natural light, there's very little light. I'm shooting 1600 ISO with a f1.4 lens, and it's dark enough that sometimes the cameras go, I can't focus on that. Digital is okay. You know, the problem is that digital noise, when you come to print it, does not look like grain. And fast black and white film has grain qualities that are just part of what makes it a beautiful image. And a black and white film has this enormous latitude. So we've all seen the sort of, you know, the histogram of the colour image, where what happened is you screwed up the exposure and the highlights fell off the end. And you will never get them back. It's like shooting with slide film, but with a few more stops of room. With black and white film, if you've overexposed something, well, you just use a different grade of paper when you come to print it, or you make sure that the scanner's exposing more to just pull that detail out of it. It's very, very hard to lose the detail from an overexposed black and white shot. It's good if you manage to overexpose the whole roll consistently, then it's good to let the guy doing the developing know. But most of the time, you're kind of all right. There's an astonishing series of photos by a photographer called Mark Sitrett, who is based in San Francisco, who is a stunning photographer. And his book, Along the Way, has on the cover an interior of a power plant that was being demolished, and he was photographing the process. And it's this astonishing black and white image of this concrete room completely empty with just one door open letting the light from outside. And I read an interview with him talking about this, and he said that when he metered for it, there were something like 13 stops of difference between the light coming in at the door and the light in the most shadowed area. Now, if you've read your Ansel Adams, you'll know that the black and white print has 10 stops available to it, of which 5 have got detail in them. Mark Sitrett has developed a printing process which takes that 13-stop range, so massive underexposure, so you have to really do a really big overexposure of the bright areas to get you expose for the shadows in black and white. In slide and in digital, you expose for the highlights, because that's what you keep. And I'm kind of used to exposing for the shadows as well. He's developed this printing process that lets him compress that astonishing dynamic range of light into something which prints beautifully on standard paper, which has these 5 stops of detail. And yeah, it goes into paper black and it goes into bright white, but only in a smaller area. And digital just doesn't let you take these kind of extreme photographs, which most of the time you don't take extreme photographs, but in the environment here where your light is in point sources all over the room, you kind of end up with a situation where there are two or three stops of detail on someone's face, which is gonna, if you're not very, very careful with your exposure with digital, is gonna mean you're gonna lose something. And okay, you can look at the histogram after and go, oh bollocks, and shoot again, but you've lost the shot, the guy's gone, the moment has passed. And admittedly, on film, if I've cocked up the exposure, it's gone. The moment has passed, and there's no way I'm getting it back. But I have the advantage that I can't see that, so I can't worry about it.
Pierce Colley on black and white photography. You'll find more links in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future or by looking at the lyric tag for this MP3. Pierce was one of those people that I was talking to at EuroOSCON who I found so interesting that I asked if I could record them. Another was Douglas Arianis of Campware.org. We talked about community radio and the wide range of help his group is giving to stations all over the world.
Well, we work with independent media in emerging democracies. An emerging democracy is usually, they're countries that could go either way. They could go back into chaos or they could go forward toward democracy. We build tools that support independent media in these countries. They can fight for transparency in local government. They can help to decrease ethnic tensions. They can do investigative stories on various things. They can report against oligarchy or against a bad economic situation. But at the same time, they can also provide local voices and local perspectives on things. I was just in Freetown in Sierra Leone. And I went to visit a radio station called Citizen FM. It's in the eastern part of Freetown, and it's like a gigantic shanty town. More than 300,000 people living in absolutely terrible circumstances. But as I was driving through this part of town, literally every radio station was tuned to this Citizen FM. And, that for me is an example of a great community radio station. It's totally tied to the interests of the people around it. Some of the people that we've worked with have had their servers seized. They've been beaten. They're dealing with harassment from hostile governments. It's difficult sometimes. But usually the main difficulty is economic. No access to capital to grow. No access to advertising revenue. So what we do in our sort of core activity is to provide financing. And when we provide financing, what we found is we give loans instead of grants. What that means is that the organization, whether it's a radio station or a newspaper or whatever it is, they need to focus on the bottom line more. And that gets them to be sustainable. And it also helps to ensure that they're independent. Because there's a big difference between being an independent media outlet and being an opposition media. Radios are everywhere, and batteries are everywhere. That's not an issue. In Freetown, generators are the issue. A radio station needs a pretty big diesel generator to power the transmitter, to power the studio. Obviously, solar would make a lot more sense, and that would be great to see that happen. But really, the situation on the ground right now is one where you have generators. We've developed a suite of open source applications. One is a newsroom CMS, a content management system. It's called Campsite. And that's really a specialized CMS for news organizations. Has things like support for paid subscriptions. It's got workflow in it. It's got a whole lot of different really neat features. One of them is article attachments. So a reporter does an interview, like you're interviewing me now. You not only can write up the text of the article, but you can also have the MP3, and it's easy for the journalist to attach that media directly to the article itself. So that makes a lot of sense in that case. But we've also done a project called Live Support. And Live Support is an open source radio playout and automation system. So what it does is if you have a Linux PC, it will turn it into just about everything that you need to run a radio station. Obviously, you should have a mic mixer. You probably should have an FM transmitter of some sort, but you could also just send out an internet stream. And you can do two things with it. One is that you can work live in the studio. You know, and that works sort of like any media player. The big difference is that you can also preview on a second sound channel, sound card. You can preview the songs or the files that you're going to play. But the other thing is that you can make a playlist and then schedule the playlist to play at a certain date and time, which means that you can run the station in automatic mode, which is great for a community radio station because you're always having a hard time getting somebody to do the midnight to six shift, right? But the other thing that we did with this is that the guy who wrote the spec for the software is actually the chief engineer for Radio TV B92 in Belgrade in Serbia. B92's had some difficulties in the past. I mean, under Milosevic, they were shut down several times. And they managed, through a bunch of really interesting means, to stay on the air. So they did things like, at one point, they had to send out a real audio stream out to Access for All in the Netherlands, which was then picked up by the BBC and broadcast back into Serbia, right? Another time, they actually set up a separate transmitter just over the border in Bosnia, and then used Timbuktu, the desktop remote control application, to connect up to that and manage the broadcast that way. So he says, well, you know, what we really need is a web interface to the system. So using any web browser, you can do things like adding audio, make a playlist, schedule a playlist, and also upload and download files from the network server if you're connected to a network of other like-minded stations. Most of these are existing radio stations. They know how to do radio. It's just that they may not necessarily know these technologies. But these are people who are pros. They've been doing radio for quite a long time. And, you know, they've taught me as probably more than I've ever taught them. So it's really a matter of training them on things like how to convert analog audio into digital, how to upload an MP3 into the system, you know, how to edit using something like Audacity. We do a lot of training with Audacity. Those are the kinds of trainings that we do. We had a feature that we had to leave out just for time constraints, which would take a playlist and render it to a single file. That's the big drawback right now with iTunes, in that iTunes only handles single files. So that was a feature that we expect to have in the next release, probably in November, December. People can get involved in a lot of different ways. The code that we have is pretty well documented. You can come to our site and check it out. The site is called campware.org, www.campware.org, campware.org. You can first off, use the software. Get familiar with what we're doing. Get familiar with our concepts. It works really well with Ubuntu. It will work with other distributions. There is a Gentoo e-build for it. And it works pretty well with Debian as well. I think it's Debian Sarge. With a little bit of messing around with a couple of the configuration files, it'll work on any Linux distribution. So you can install it, get familiar with it, start to test it, give us feedback. We have a list a mile long of features that people want. But what we don't have right now is a lot of people who are actually able to make those features happen. You know, we're a small team of developers. We have, I think right now on the live support team, there are probably four people working on it on a consistent basis. But we really need more. And there are a lot of great ideas for things that we need. Voice tracking would be a perfect example. We would love to have voice tracking. It's just a matter of getting some coders in to actually work on stuff like that. That would be absolutely what we would love to have.
Douglas Arianis at campware.org. Thanks also to Pierce Cawley, James Duncan Davidson, and the group of developers who let me follow them around Brussels, including the voices of Eve, Svet, Stephen, Yuri, Kathy, and Bert. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro. It was run through Gigavox's Levelator at least once.